nerve was struck in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The women strikers wanted more than life's bare necessities. They carried banners demanding bread and roses.
Good evening. This is the last program, the 11 to midnight program on this day, Women's Health Day, here at WBAI. This program is going to be kind of a medical magazine, a potpourri of three short pieces, well, one not so short perhaps, dealing with women's health issues. Before I begin, I'd like to do something that I sort of decided I was going to do throughout the day, and that's just list a few information, medical information sources that women should know about in this city. One is the Center for Medical Consumer Information at 410 East 62nd Street, and the telephone number for that is 752-8558. This is a consumer information center, and it's also a library which has both lay books and medical books. It also has a tape library which women can dial, dealing with some very basic women's health issues. Another resource is Health Pack at 17 Murray Street. It's the Health Policy Advisory Council. It's a research, writing, and publishing collective interested in the issues of health policy, the social, economic, and political issues of health care. It publishes a bi-monthly bulletin, the Health Pack Bulletin. The number there is 267-8890. Another very important resource, women's health resource, is HealthRight, the Women's Health Forum. The HealthRight is also a collective. It's a women's health collective. It publishes a quarterly newsletter. It publishes information pamphlets on women's health issues. And it also provides women's health information to women who phone and request that information. The number again for HealthRight, the Women's Health Forum, is 674-3660. Some books that women may want to be acquainted with if you have a medical problem and want to do your own research. One important book is a physician's desk reference, which deals with drugs. Another is the Merck Manual, which lists diseases and their symptoms and their possible therapies. Another is the New York State Medical Directory, which is a listing of physicians in New York State who are licensed by New York State. There's also the Directory of Medical Specialists, which lists medical specialists. And by looking in that, a woman can find out for sure if the doctor she's going to is in fact a specialist, which means that he or she has his or her boards. There's Women's Counseling Project. The number is 280-5113, and that gives information, medical recommendations if a woman needs a doctor. Another health, women's health group is the Feminist Center for Human Growth and Development at 40 East 68th Street. That's a gynecological self-health center. It also specializes in crisis counseling. It has groups on mothers and daughters, and it's open on Saturday. And the telephone number there is 535-8505. Two other numbers that women may be interested in knowing about are the People's Health Center. At the telephone number there is 583-8010, and that's a health center in the Bronx. Another is St. Mark's Clinic. The telephone number there is 583-8010. And St. Mark's Center, St. Mark's Clinic, excuse me, has a women's health night every Tuesday evening, specializing in the problems of lesbian women and older women, but definitely dealing with the problems of all women. There's something else I think women interested in women's health and interested in women's issues want to know about, and that is that there's a demonstration next Saturday being run by CARASA, CESA, the Medical Committee on Human Rights, and several groups that have come together on the abortion issue. This is a demonstration against the Medicaid cutbacks for abortion, and the reason for the demonstration is that Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare Califano is coming to NYU Law School to receive an award of sorts, and he is going to be rewarded by the women in this coalition with a demonstration. That demonstration will take place next Saturday at 1 p.m. at the NYU Law School, which is at Washington Square. There'll be a picketing beginning at 1 p.m. and a rally beginning at 3 p.m. Okay, now, what we're going to do is we're going to have some brief pieces, as I said, three pieces. And the first piece is a piece on mammography. Recently, there's been new evidence that mammography, which was used as a mass screening program for breast cancer over the past few years, may not be either as effective or as safe as it was previously thought. The piece is an interview with Judith Randall, who was the science and medical writer for the New York Daily News, the Washington Bureau, who has done some of the investigative work on mammography. She had an extensive article in the Washington Post a few months ago. So we'll hear this tape, and then we're going to have just some more comments on the same topic. What is mammography?
Mammography is an X-ray technique for the detection of breast cancer.
When was it first used and why?
I'm going to have to guess on exact dates, but it was used as early as the late 1950s in Philadelphia, where it was developed at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine as a tool for detecting breast cancer.
When was it first used extensively in mass screening projects?
In the early and mid-60s, there was a project at the Health Insurance Plan of Greater New York, which looked at, I forget how many women, but several thousand. Based on the experience from the Health Insurance Plan in Greater New York, it was decided to launch a larger-scale program involving about 280,000 women in 27 centers across the country.
Why was this decision made?
Well, that's a very complicated question. Allegedly, it was felt that the HIP experience in New York City had demonstrated the value of using this as a screening technique in women who had no apparent symptoms. Now, as it turns out, they enrolled women between women 35 years and older, and it has turned out since that there was no demonstrated benefit for women under 50. But they went ahead and did the project anyway.
Why did they go ahead with the project anyway?
Well, that's a very complicated question, but there was no controversy about it at the time, but first of all, it was felt that because it was a very highly visible project, it would be good publicity. There are documents on file showing that it would predispose people kindly toward the cancer effort, and there were also people who sincerely felt that it would have a demonstrable health benefit. There were also those, I should say, who felt quite the opposite.
When were questions first really raised about the possible benefits of mammography and also the possible risks of mammography.
Questions raised before the project was even started, because, of course, it was known at the time that any exposure to radiation, however small, increases the eventual risk of cancer.
When were questions raised in such a way that people began to think in terms of taking some action to perhaps halt or limit the program?
Well, not probably. Well, until 1976, I would say, although Dr. John Baylor of the Cancer Institute had begun to raise questions in 1975 publicly, but there are documents that one can obtain under the Freedom of Information Act showing that there were questions raised about the project before it started. It started in 73, and there were, in the planning phases in 1972, there were questions raised.
What do we know about mammography now in terms of its possible benefits as a diagnostic tool and also in terms of its possible risks?
Well, let's distinguish between two things. There are women of whatever age for whom it is definitely beneficial. Women who have symptoms such as discharge from the nipples or noticeable lumps or severe pain. For those women, it is certainly worthwhile. We also know that it is worthwhile for women over 50, regardless of whether they fall into these groups. We also know that for a woman under 50 who herself has already had breast cancer or who has had a mother or sister with the disease, that mammography is indicated. Now, the National Cancer Institute guidelines for mammography say that if a woman is 35 to 40 and herself has had breast cancer, it's certainly indicated. But that's a complicated question. We also know that there is a slight risk, depending, and the risk depends on the dose and the sensitivity of the individual woman, that exposure to X-rays will itself slightly increase the risk of cancer, of breast cancer. And that for the woman who has not herself had cancer, who is under 50, and who does not have a female relative who had the disease, the procedure is not routinely advised.
Now, what does this tell us, the fact that this happened, that in a sense for a long time this was recommended, and now we know that perhaps it wasn't the wisest procedure? What does this say about the way the healthcare system has been working?
Well, it says that in this particular instance, this study was inadvisedly drawn up, that people who had contrary views were systematically excluded. And one of the problems with the whole study is there was no control group. And that sounds like a technical term, but what it means is that it wasn't scientifically designed in such a way so that one is going to be able to learn anything scientifically valuable from this experience. In other words, there was no group of women who were not getting mammography who can be followed so that they can be compared with those who did.
Well, one other question, that is, in a recent issue of Science magazine, there was an article about the mammography controversy in which the whole question of how important early detection is was raised. Can you comment on that? Is that being raised now as a real question?
One of the things about mammography and there is that it is best at detecting small lesions less than half an inch around. And nobody knows what the natural history of these lesions is. Now, in lay terms, that means that no one knows whether these tiny growths will themselves ever become invasive and spread and prove life-threatening.
So what you're saying is that there is a possibility, although by no means any firm evidence, that perhaps if these small lesions detected by mammography were left untouched, that they would not develop into a life-threatening illness in the course of a woman's natural lifetime.
Studies are suggesting that is true. It is controversial, but there is quite a lot of evidence to suggest that that is indeed the case.
Okay, are there any other comments you'd like to make about this whole question?
Well, I think there were two basic difficulties there were two important ones, and one of them was that there was no informed consent about the exposure to radiation when women were recruited for this project. They were not told that there was any risk with radiation. And they were also not told that in the previous studies, the health insurance plan study upon which this more recent project has been modeled, there was no demonstrated benefit for women under 50. The project was billed as a demonstration project rather than an experiment, but the fact of the matter is that there have been no demonstration that this procedure was useful in this group of apparently healthy women.
From Science Magazine, 14th of October, 1977. The Recommendations. Throughout the past 2 years, the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society have met frequently to reconsider the guidelines for the Breast Cancer Detection Demonstration Project. Last May, the Cancer Institute issued new regulations limiting the scope of the project. In the main, the consensus panel simply reinforced those limits, although it added a couple of additional restrictions. As they stand now, the principal guidelines in effect are these. 1. Mammography screening should be available to women over 50. 2. For women between the ages of 40 and 49, mammography should be used only for those who have had breast cancer or who have a mother or sister who has had the disease. 3. For women between the ages of 35 and 39, mammography should be used only if a woman has previously had cancer in one breast. Here, the panel is taking a tougher stance than the NCI had previously when it said mammography should be given to those younger women if they had a family history of breast cancer. 4. Thermograph, the examination of breast tissues by heat rather than X-ray, has not been proved to be valuable and should be dropped from the program, although it should still be studied. 5. Mammography should never be used to screen women under 35. 6. Mammography should be used for women of any age to aid in the diagnosis of a suspected tumor.
The next piece on this last magazine program on this Women's Health Day, November 5th, 1977, here at WBAI, is a piece that was prepared for the Sledgehammer that will be aired tomorrow and is an interview with Barbara Seaman, who has done some of the really important work on the effects of sex hormones in women. This is an interview in which he discusses the insertion of warning material into the drug packets.
And I was informed that I would be a lifetime anticoagulant patient. I live in constant pain as a result of the damage done.
There's one group of drugs where many people have felt particularly strongly that it was unjustified not to have complete patient warning. These are estrogens. They include the birth control pill, estrogens that are used to treat menopausal women, estrogens that are used as lactation suppressants, and for a number of other purposes in medicine. The reason that estrogens have been a particular focus of attention for people interested in women's health and consumer groups generally is, number one, that these are unlike any other drugs, which have mainly a narrow function. These are very potent modifiers of the entire body function. They work through the higher brain centers, and they affect every cell and organ in the body.
Just heard the voice of Barbara Seaman, writer on women's health issues and member of the National Women's Health Network. She was speaking at a press conference held on Monday, October 17th, concerning a recent court decision that ordered pharmaceutical companies to insert patient warnings in all prescriptions containing estrogen. Also at the press conference were Mrs. Doris Hare, president of the American Foundation for Maternal and Child Health, and Dr. Michelle Harrison, recipient of the Feminist Physician Award. There was personal testimony from two women who had suffered lifetime physical damage directly attributed to estrogen therapy. The women are Kitty Callan, the singer, and Genevieve Pierce, whom you heard a few minutes ago telling part of their stories.
I've had a very active career since I was a child. I was the typical female, intimidated. My basic instincts were to stay young and beautiful. Everything I'd read about estrogen therapy really whet my appetite. Had a few wrinkles in my face. I asked Dr. Arnkite what he thought of estrogen therapy as an age deterrent with my history of a pelvic post-op cervicitis. Said he, no problem. He prescribed Premarin. I took Premarin for 10 months. In 1967, I had a series of the most excruciating pains. The only way I can describe it is unbearable.
Yes, I tried to be the kind of woman he wanted me to be, and I tried to see life your way and say all the things you'd like me to say. Loving thoughts, gentle hands, all guaranteed to keep a hold of your man. Made to please and not to tease, it's the custom-made woman blues.
In 1971, I found a lump in my left breast, doing what all good laymen are supposed to do. I took it to a doctor. He said, don't worry about it, but I don't know anything about lumps. He was a GP. He said, go to your gynecologist. So I did. He said, don't worry about it. Then, in the course of that year, I had a pap smear. The result of that pap smear indicated to the GP that my body was not producing enough estrogen. So he put me on Premarin. So I went back to the gynecologist and his partner, and I said, hey, I still have a lump. Now I'm on Premarin. What happened? No biopsy was ever done. No mammogram was ever suggested. However, in 74, I had a mastectomy. Next week, I go in for another biopsy. I think if this insert had been in the package, I would never have even considered taking it.
Ms. Seaman, Mrs. Hare, and Dr. Harrison described the struggle to win the mandatory warnings.
The FDA mandated that as of last September 20th, the warnings would begin being shipped in the estrogen packages. Last summer, in response to this, the pharmaceutical manufacturers, supported, I'm very sad to say, by the gynecologist organization and the internist organization, filed an injunction in the U.S. District Court in Delaware to try to stop the labeling. Then a coalition of women's and consumer groups filed as friends of the court on the FDA's side concerning the right to have the labeling. The complainants were Consumers Union, the National Women's Health Network, which is our group that Dr. Harrison and Mrs. Hare and I are from, the Consumers Research Council, and the Women's Equity Action. The judge in Delaware has just delivered a decision that the threat to women's lives is more imperative than the threat to the drug company profits. He has ordered that as of the 18th of October, any woman receiving a prescription for estrogen has the right to expect a very long, detailed warning with it. When the news about the DES daughters had gotten so bad, the relationship between estrogens and cancer of the endometrium had gotten so bad, when the tentative news about breast cancer was mounting, finally, about a year and a half ago, the commissioner and the head of the Bureau of Drugs again promised to put comprehensive labeling in all of these products for the patient.
In support of the FDA's patient package insert on estrogen, it must be remembered, one, the discomforts of menopause are not life-threatening. The treatment may be. Two, informed decisions can only be made on the basis of education. Three, the use of replacement estrogen for menopausal women is often based on the physician's value systems and assumptions of what women should be or should look like, rather than the values or priorities of the woman herself. Physicians have not always accepted or communicated dangers to patients. The suit against the FDA is based on the assumption that women are not capable of making informed decisions and that they must depend on their physicians to decide for them what will be their priorities during their menopausal years. The average American does not realize that the FDA does not guarantee the safety of any drug it approves as safe and effective. The reporting of an adverse drug reaction to the FDA by a physician is completely voluntary, so that there is no national data of the true damage of FDA-approved drugs. Dr. Richard Kraut, who is director of the Bureau of Drugs, recently told me that the FDA has no specific definition of safe. Fatality is not, to me, the major issue. It's how many women are living damaged. Until such time as the Food and Drug Administration sees that every drug has a package insert suitable for the user or the patient, that the Food and Drug Administration should be liable or responsible for the care and treatment of any individual harmed or damaged by drugs approved as safe by the FDA.
And now you say you're tired of me and all of those things I thought you wanted me to be. Is it true you want someone who knows how to think and do on her own? Lord, it's hard to realize the lessons I learned.
That piece was prepared for the Women's Department of WBAI by Rose Jordan. The next piece on this Women's Health magazine is a play by Myra Lamb that was performed at a Carasa meeting a few weeks ago.
Playwrights have been brought out of mothballs because of the incipient recriminalization of the abortion laws. I thought this play was finished in 73. It was agitprop, and I would have been happy to see it retired. But it's been a good tool, and it has worked, as a matter of fact, around the world, some strange places like Japan, Italy. I don't think it's gotten to Australia. Here it is again. It's an argument. I'm going to play the part of the woman, and Arthur Berwick is going to be doing penance for the fact that he's played 2.5 years as Dale Harding in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's going to play the part of the man. This is, as many people may know, a role reversal, a bit of agitprop, and it has been effective. I haven't done much acting of late, or even much speech making, and I have about 3 things to say that I haven't had the opportunity to say to a public. One thing I thought very significant was a report, a majority report, about the fact that 5 American Nazis, male American Nazis, were elected to that delegation that's going to Houston. It makes perfect sense to me as a natural extension of everything else that's going down. The other thing is that the Son of Sam scandal, it was very interesting. Everybody was so fascinated with a man who really doesn't seem to have lived or have any potential for life. All he seems to have is a potential to destroy the lives of others.